How much say do politicians have over civics curriculum? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday. It's May 26th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Governor Kristi Noem asks individual members of the Board of Regents to pay attention to how they appropriate money in ways the governor might not support, the Dakota Political Junkies discuss. Are people moving to South Dakota because of politics? Are they moving away because of politics? SDPB's Megan Feary has that story. If politics is giving you knots in your stomach, we talk about how to listen to your gut with the Prairie Doc. We take a moment to honor the unsung gathering space that is the local record store, and Nate Weck is with us to talk state track and field. We are broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. The National Weather Service confirms four tornadoes touched down last Sunday in western South Dakota. Cleanup efforts are underway in Perkins and Custer counties. Houses and sheds received some damage. Some trees were uprooted as well. No injuries or deaths are reported. One horse died. Stephen Esser is the Custer County Director of Emergency Management. He says power lines were damaged and caused a blackout.
I would say over 300 people were without power after the storm.
Power has since been restored. Esser plans to assess damage with a drone.
We're hoping to get some aerial footage from that, and maybe we can do some, guesstimates as far as acreage.
Custer County Emergency Management is compiling the total cost of damage caused by the storm. Governor Kristi Noem has formed a federal political action committee, indicating her growing fundraising prowess and national ambitions. The Republican insists she's focused on getting reelected as governor next year, but her nationwide fundraising network has fueled speculation that she could be eyeing a 2024 presidential bid. Last week, her campaign registered a PAC called Noem Victory Fund with the Federal Elections Commission. Campaign finance experts say the move means the PAC can distribute funds into elections beyond South Dakota and create a pot of money that could be put into a future campaign for federal office. A lawyer who previously ran a black metal label that included anti-Semitic and white supremacist music is trying again to be admitted to the South Dakota Bar. Aaron Wayne Davis made his pitch to the South Dakota Supreme Court. Davis tried for admission in 2019, but the Supreme Court rejected that application. Victoria Wicks has more of the story for SDPB.
In August 2017, City Pages published an article featuring Aaron Wayne Davis, an intellectual property lawyer in Minneapolis who also ran Behold Barbarity Records. The label offered music with violently anti-Semitic and racist lyrics and merchandise with neo-Nazi symbolism. The article noted Davis also organized an annual satanic music festival in Chicago and that the Southern Poverty Law Center listed Behold Barbarity as an active hate group. Now Davis is 47 years old and says he lives in Custer with his wife and two toddlers. He tells the state Supreme Court that he has practiced law for 18 years with a spotless disciplinary record. He says he regrets that his past music sales have undercut his life's mission to help all people in need.
And I've shown that over the course of decades by helping people in sobriety, helping people on a pro bono basis in my work, and I've represented him on a paying basis every conceivable color, creed, religion of every person that's out there.
Davis says he has never personally attacked anyone for racial or religious reasons. He says he has maintained sobriety for years and sponsors others. He had a kidney transplant last fall, and he assists his family, which he says is racially mixed.
I'm not burning crosses and going to, rallies and things like that. I'm living I never have done anything like that. I live a very family-oriented life, and that's the way I'd like to keep it.
Davis says these factors prove he is of good character to practice law in South Dakota. Justices will deliberate and release their decision at a later date. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City.
For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. How bad is the drought and how is it impacting grain prices? According to a report released this morning, some in the farming sector and meteorologists are starting to compare current drought conditions to those of the 2012 growing season. Kevin McNew is chief economist with Farmers Business Network, and he's joining us now with an update. Kevin, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
What are we seeing right now for drought predictions that are evocative of 2012?
You know, there are some similarities. You're seeing a fairly wide swath of the grain belt that is certainly dry and in various stages of drought. The western part of the U.S. is in a really wide-scale drought. So I think those are kind of the similarities, but one of the big differences is what's kind of going on in kind of the Gulf of Mexico region and the moisture that is able to come out of the Gulf of Mexico this year is actually pretty wide scale. We're seeing a lot of moisture that is coming into the kind of the lower delta and pushing up into parts of the grain belt. That wasn't the case in 2012. In 2012, you had moisture that was kind of prevented from making landfall, and that really cut off a key source of moisture into the heart of the growing season. So while I think there's a lot of growing season left, and there's certainly some drought conditions that are going to be something to watch, I'm not as fearful, let's say, of what we saw happening this year that we saw in 2012.
How is the information that we do know and the predictions of drought really impacting prices right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's markets are always kind of a give and take. They live and breathe on the latest weather forecasts. And so, quite honestly, in the last week or so, we've seen prices come down because we're starting to see more moisture in some key growing areas like Iowa, Nebraska, you know, in the northern plains of South Dakota, North Dakota, maybe not as much. Minnesota also dry. But, you know, I think the markets have breathed a little bit of sigh of relief at the early part of the season where we are seeing a little bit more moisture. But, you know, one thing I would say is that, you know, this year is going to be hard for the weather models to predict because we don't have kind of that dominant force of either an El Nino or a La Nina for them to rely on. And so we're kind of in this almost call it bipolar mode, where we're sometimes sort of like a La Nina phase that we were in the winter, but then sometimes we want to tend towards a different weather pattern. So the models are not necessarily doing a great job of predicting, especially precipitation far out into the future. So there's a lot of uncertainty as we go into the growing season.
Well, as we look at that, it's not the same thing as uncertainty about whether it will rain on your picnic, because decisions have to be made at certain times. So let's talk about mitigating risk or minimizing risk. What are some of the recommendations that you have for farmers and producers right now?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on kind of where you're at and what your, you know, are you a livestock producer, are you a crop producer? You know, for the crop producers we work with, and especially, like I mentioned, those areas in the northern plains, upper Midwest, Minnesota, where they are dry, they may need to think more proactively about getting, you know, herbicide applications done sooner rather than later, because basically the physiology of crops is and weeds is once they sort of shut down, their skin, their texture on the leaves gets more brittle. It gets harder for herbicides to penetrate, and so you can certainly run into issues where if you're applying them later than normal or even normal, you may not get very good good applications done. So we're encouraging farmers to be a little more proactive about, you know, getting herbicides down before the effects of drought stick in, using things like adjuvants that can help break down kind of the waxy texture on leaves is one thing. Livestock producers in particular, I think, are really going to be in kind of dire straits because they're facing not only escalating feed prices, but, you know, as pasture starts to run dry and hay becomes difficult to source, you're going to have to make tough decisions. You know, can I find replacement, feeding, or do I need to, you know, move my cattle to market, in some sort of situation that's not necessarily ideal? So those are kind of the things I would encourage producers to be thinking about right now.
Kevin McNew is chief economist with Farmers Business Network. Thanks again. It's always a pleasure to have you with fresh insight.
Thank you, Lori.
Later in the hour, we're going to talk politics with the Dakota Political Junkies. If politics has your stomach in knots, fear not. We'll talk about taking care of your gut health first. You're in the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. The Sovereign Bodies Institute reports 173 missing or murdered Indigenous women in our state. Most of those cases remain unsolved. We hear stories from the Capitol Building in Pierre, where loved ones gather to call for justice. Plus, a visit to the only long-term shelter for human trafficking victims in South Dakota. That and more, Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
Program funding by Denny Menhold Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City, inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menhold Rapid Chevrolet. See you at Denny Menhold Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City.
Hi, it's Julie Rose, host of Top of Mind. Memorial Day marks the traditional beginning of summer. It's also a time to revere sacrifices made by others so that we can enjoy our freedoms. My team has put together a special hour featuring conversations about legacies and memorials. We'll learn about projects to collect soldiers' letters and to preserve veterans' memories. I hope you'll join us.
Listen Memorial Day at noon Central, 11 Mountain, and 7 Central, 6 Mountain, here on SDPB.
Quality news reporting is more important than ever. Your financial support is more important to us than ever. Support radio that's important to you. Become a member of SDPB today. SDPB.org/donate. Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. So much of your overall health can be tied to the health of your gut. But if your stomach is in knots, that doesn't mean you can't find solutions to your woes. Dr. Andrew Ellsworth is a family medicine physician. He's with Avera Medical Group in Brookings. And he's a member of that On Call with the Prairie Doc team. And he's joining us now for a preview of the Prairie Doc program, Listen to Your Gut. Dr. Ellsworth, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much again, Lori.
All right. This is something that we always hear, you know, your gut is your second brain. Anxiety is tied into your gut health. What you eat matters, and it can be all kind of overwhelming. But is it true? I mean, how important is the health of your digestive system or your gastrointestinal tract?
Yeah, you know, so much of what we're feeling can often be tied to what we're putting into our bodies, and what we're doing. And so, you know, and so many times if we just kind of listen to our bodies, it'll tell us what we need or if something's wrong. And you can apply that to so many different organ systems, not just your GI system, your gut. But, you know, it's one of those things where if you kind of don't feel well after having fast food, maybe you shouldn't have fast food anymore.
Yeah. Is it that obvious? I mean, how soon are you going to know if it's a dietary problem? How good do we have to be and how often can we cheat?
Yeah. Everyone's different. And, yeah. And it is amazing how, though, if you start keeping track or really watching or, you know, kind of, you know, going back to the fast food thing, you know, mm-hmm. you might not realize it, but then you, let's say you went a month without fast food and then you had fast food, then you notice, oh, wow, I don't feel near as good as if I was eating that healthy salad for lunch.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the common problems for this On Call with the Prairie Doc episode on Thursday night. Acid reflux. Let's start there. What exactly is happening for people who are experiencing noticeable acid reflux or heartburn?
Yeah, you know, our stomach uses acid to help process and break down our food, but various lifestyle factors, eating too much, eating spicy foods, caffeine or coffee or eating before bedtime and so on can increase or cause too much acid there that can end up going up into our esophagus or the tube, you know, between mm-hmm. our throat and our stomach, or even up in the back of our throat and can cause burning pain. Sometimes we call that heartburn or reflux. And so it's a common problem and often can cause pain in the upper middle or a sore throat or a hoarse voice or trouble swallowing. And the list goes on. And if it goes unchecked, I mean, the person can end up with an ulcer or even can over time contribute to causing cancer. So it is something that's good to get it taken care of.
Yeah. When do you know it's a problem versus an occasional thing that you can just take a Tums or do, you know, or lay off the spicy food before bed? When is it something you need to talk to your doctor about?
Yeah. You know, if it's really sporadic where, yeah, you know exactly what you did, you ate, you know, whatever spicy food or tacos or something and that ate too much of it. Yeah. Then, you know, you need to change your diet and watch it. And if it's just a Tums once in a while, okay. But if it's, you know, more than, I don't know, a couple times a month, then it's probably something you should think about getting looked at, make sure there's not something else going on. Mm. Sometimes we blame it on acid reflux when there's something else going on. And so it's good to talk to your doctor about that if it's happening more consistently and get it looked into.
Yeah, I want to go back to something you said a minute ago about keeping track. And food logs are difficult for me. I just, you know, I could do it for a day or two and then I fall off. But as a physician, when somebody comes in and says, I'm having problem X, whatever it would be, how important and useful is a good daily log of how you're feeling, how you're moving food through your system and what you're eating?
Yeah, it really helps with the insight, not just for your doctor, but for yourself too, to know how does this affect me? How does it make me feel? You know, and completely different. I just had a patient with diabetes that had uncontrolled for years and they got one of those continuous glucose monitors and they can easily check their sugars. And it's really made a revolutionary change for them with this insight on how their food is affecting their blood sugar. And now they're finally under control after not for years and years. And it is amazing how that feedback, whether it's keeping track of your calories, keeping track of your sugars, keeping track of your diet. And after a while, you know, it becomes intuitive and you just kind of know. But it all that insight into your own body, listening to your body and paying attention can really give you the tools to get things better.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of those big ones because we think about colonoscopies and, you know, colon cancer. Tell us a little bit about, you know, has anything changed recently about how often you should get cancer screenings and how you should get cancer screenings?
Well, we have seen colon cancers decrease, thankfully, over the last several decades because of the colonoscopies. We can find these polyps and take care of them easily before they grow into cancer. But we are seeing them show up in younger ages. And so there are some national organizations saying maybe we should start doing these at age 45 or so. It's taking some time to get the insurance companies to catch up and go ahead and pay for that. So it ends up being an individual basis based on your family history. If you have a family history of colon cancer, if you have a history of polyps yourself, or if you're having symptoms, if you're having abdominal pain or blood in your stool especially, that's something you should always get checked out. And so there's reasons we should do it earlier, but for the most part, at least at age 50, we want to start doing them. But some people even younger in the 40s or age 45, and that's something to talk to your provider about.
Yeah, having that relationship with your provider. How about the whole, you know, just one last question, organic food or no sugar or just, you know, can that really make a difference in preventing cancers? Again, it goes back to how good do we have to be, but is there an increase in cancer because of our processed diets? Scientifically, are they linked?
It is. There have been plenty of studies now looking and finding this association, not necessarily cause, because it's not, you know, plenty of people that never eat all that stuff all the time and processed meats and so on and don't have a problem. But, you know, maybe that is part of the reason for these increased rates of cancers and colon cancer. And so there's been some studies that saw this association between processed meats, especially maybe some processed grains and colon cancer specifically, but other issues too sometimes. So in general, those whole foods and natural foods and fruits and vegetables and, you know, less packaging and more freshness is typically going to be better for you.
Always a good thing. All right. Dr. Andrew Ellsworth, he's a family medicine physician with the Vera Medical Group in Brookings. He's a member of the On Call with the Prairie Doc team, and you can tune in to On Call with the Prairie Doc on Thursdays. It's on SDPB TV1 at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain. You can also watch on the Prairie Doc Facebook page. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thank you, Lori. Stay healthy out there, people.
Thanks. Up next, the politics of patriotic education. Dakota Political Junkies Pam Caribou and John Schaff are with us for that. You are in the moment, South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Miles Davis was a constantly evolving musician who was in the center or at the forefront of the many changes in jazz from the late 1940s through the 80s. He remains one of the most important and influential musicians in the entire history of jazz. Davis was born 95 years ago today, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll celebrate the trumpeter's birth with a few of his classic recordings. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by Bank West, a full-service community bank, helping you make the most of your time and money, and being there how, when, and where you want to bank. Bank West. Convenient. Connected. Committed. Member FDIC.
South Dakota Home Garden offers more opportunities for you to learn during South Dakota's short but sweet growing season. SDPB makes it easier by sharing gardening advice across all our platforms. Join us on TV, radio, and online at sdpb.org/sdhomegarden to keep your gardening ideas fresh this season.
SDPB radio listeners are company presidents, board members, and top executives in businesses around the state. Your company can reach these influential business leaders. Contact SDPB and ask about corporate support.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Christy Noem is asking the South Dakota Board of Regents to consider whether appropriated funds are being used, quote, in a manner that neither the legislative nor the executive branch would support, end quote. Plus, as speculation about potential retirement for U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell increases, South Dakotans are contemplating the political future of South Dakota U.S. Senator John Thune. Our rotating panel of Dakota Political Junkies provides weekly analysis of state and national political news. Today, we're joined by political scientists John Schaff and Pam Caribou. John Schaff is professor of political science at Northern State University, and Pam Caribou is professor of political science at Black Hills State University. Dr. Caribou, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Schaff, welcome as well.
Good to be here. It's the first time I've been on with Pam, so it's a pleasure.
Excellent. And I'm glad that you're both on together today after Governor Christy Noem sent this letter to the Board of Regents, because you're making choices at the university level about what you teach in your classes and how you encourage your students to think critically about what's in the world today. And I want to start with you, John Schaff, by just saying, help me understand the significance. What does a letter like this, what message is it trying to send? I'm not as interested in, you know, what does it do and what doesn't it do, but what message does it send to people who are on the Board of Regents, to professors?
Well, I think, first of all, since both Pam and I are Board of Regents employees, it's worth noting anything I say in this case is my own opinion, and I don't speak for my university or for the Board of Regents. It's just my own opinion. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, when you look at the governor's statement, you know, the first paragraph of it is this sort of generic statement that I think on its face no one could possibly disagree with. But I think what the governor's trying to do is, you know, there's a kind of meme out there amongst conservatives / Republicans, and it's called the Republicans pounce meme. And what it means is that when a Democrat or someone on the left does something controversial, does something bad, and then Republicans comment on it, the story is not the bad thing or, whatever controversial thing that the other person has done. It's the Republicans pounce. And I think we have a little bit of Republicans pounce here. There is a consistent effort across the country, has been for at least three decades, to politicize the curriculum under the banner. These days, we talk about decolonizing the curriculum, their efforts, especially from student services, residents' life, to politicize campuses, often with the encouragement and even mandates from accrediting bodies and federal bureaucracies. And then what's happening here, I think, is Governor Noem is pushing back. And so I think the truth is that higher education has been politicized for decades. And now there are people on the right, like Governor Noem, that are pushing back. And this might be this kind of a Republicans pounce story. I do think there's nothing in the governor's statement that suggests otherwise, that what is sacrosanct is that faculty have the right to teach what they want. For example, I taught the lead essay by Nicole Hannah Jones from the 1619 Project in my American Political Thought this past semester, something I specifically mentioned in Governor Noem's letter. I put it in context with other things, but I taught it. I think probably people who should have their ears perked up are not faculty, who I think will be given protection to teach whatever they want to teach, and we have legal protection on that. It'll be more the co-curricular things coming out of student services, residence life, these sorts of things that are probably more on the radar than other parts of the university.
Interesting. Dr. Caribou, your thoughts? What do you make of Governor Kristi Noem's letter? I was particularly keyed into this idea of funding and in a manner that the legislative and executive branch would, be supportive of. That seemed to me to be more of a direct commentary on, we're giving you the money, don't spend it on these things, pay attention to, federal funding and grants and what they're asking you to teach. What did you make of all of this?
I think it's actually, is it a real pushback? Is it a real pounce? That's what I'm wondering. Or is it positioning? Is it culture war? Is it, it's interesting that we're using these phrases, critical race theory, mm-hmm. or even talking about the 1619 Project, without really ever defining what that means and understanding what that means. And I think that's actually the intent. Christopher Rufo is a prominent critic of critical race theory. He works for the Manhattan Institute, and he's been, kind of all over the place raising concerns. But he flat out tweeted in March that the goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think critical race theory. He knows that it's not really an honest discussion of critical race theory, or let's not even use that. It's not even really an honest discussion of what professors are teaching or universities are offering to students. It's actually a way to pounce. I like that idea. That's a really good concept. It's a way to position. It's a way to raise your political stature if you're considering higher office, perhaps. But it's not really an honest discussion of what we're teaching in our classes or, what our students are thinking.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your students. And again, you're both speaking, as your personal stories, not on behalf of your universities. But I remember standing in line at Barnes & Noble one day in Sioux Falls, and there was two SDSU students behind me, or at least they were wearing SDSU gear and talking about SDSU professors. So I inferred that they went to school there, very upset about a class that was on feminist thought, and they didn't think that was necessary. And they were just having this you know, lively discussion about what they thought they should be learning and what professors were choosing to teach and what they wanted to hear again. And so, John, as you say, you've looked into the 1619 Project and brought it into your classroom with the Pulitzer mm-hmm. Prize-winning essay, which has been criticized for a few reasons publicly. What are you hearing from students? Are they, you know, are they really deeply engaged in this whole concept of, like, what is a patriotic education? When did, you know, what did the founders, suggest? Are they sort of mentally gaining something from this whole discussion back and forth? Are they more engaged because of the political debate, or does it turn them off? They're frustrated with it.
No, I think they're more engaged. And so in my own experience in teaching 1619 stuff, and I did along with a long essay, kind of an excerpt from his book of Ta-Nehisi Coates, is they take these more contemporary, you might say more critical takes on American race and compare that, say, to Frederick Douglass and Martin Luther King or even Booker Washington and W.B. Du Bois. And students can see that there's a dialogue to be had amongst these various authors. And I think the concern is that, and it's not so much what teachers teach in the classroom. What we get from co-curricular parts of the university, then also I would say simply in the way that the curriculum is constructed, are students getting a context or a wide variety of views, which is why I've stated over and over, the most important diversity at a university is intellectual diversity. And I will note that the Board of Regents opposed intellectual diversity legislation. Each of the institutions, each of the six institutions, opposed intellectual diversity legislation when it came up before the board, the legislature 2 years ago. The grounds for that was, we don't want unfunded mandates. Well, we have fallen in love with Big Brother when it comes to unfunded mandates from the federal government, from the Board of Regents itself, from accrediting bodies. We do. We have entire positions at our universities that do nothing but respond to unfunded mandates. So it's not really unfunded mandates that the South Dakota universities are opposed to. It's remarkable that the one unfunded mandate that they oppose is the one involving the intellectual diversity, which tells me it's not really unfunded mandates they were opposed to. It was the content of this particular mandate, which was, give us reports on intellectual diversity on your campus. And all it was reporting requirements. And that was too much for the Board of Regents and for the individual universities.
John, I remember those reporting requirements being kind of onerous. Did you think they were manageable reporting requirements? I mean, when I remember covering that as a reporter, some of the conversations we were having on the Junkies was just...
We have entire positions at my university. We spend hundreds of thousands of dollars responding to federal reports, Board of Regents reports, accrediting reports from the Higher Learning Commission, from individual reports and individual accrediting agencies for education, for business, for our School of Music or our music program. And nobody complains about those. And those are far, far more onerous than a few reports on intellectual diversity, which it tells me it is not the report that's the objection. It is what the report is about that is the objection.
Yeah, Pam Caribou, go ahead.
I would say I'm going to have to disagree on that, though. As you know, as a survey researcher, I'm actually, how would we even measure that? How do we measure intellectual diversity? How could we honestly capture that information and portray it to, you know, put it in a report in a way that actually would be valid, reliable, and without actually kind of digging into things that, frankly, my employer has no business knowing. They don't have the right to know how I vote or what I think in my personal life or those kinds of things. So I understand the point that you're making, but I actually think there's more to it than just not being willing to file the report.
I want to go and jump in here a little bit with
Heterodox Academy has a campus survey that they gave to the state of South Dakota. I signed on to a letter recommending this report when we were going through the implementation of intellectual diversity legislation, I guess that'd be 2 years ago, the summer of 2 years ago. And so it's out there, right? Created by scholars who do survey research. So it's there and can be done. And as I say, the reporting requirements were things like simply what speakers, outside speakers, are you having come on your campus, things of that nature. But I interrupted you, Lori. Go ahead.
Yeah, because I want to pivot this a little bit to the students. As a parent of a college student, I'm not a professor or an academic, but when you mentioned co-curriculars, and I want to ask Pam this question first, you know, students come with their own sort of exploration and their own minds and their own clubs. And there's something for me as a parent a little untoward about the idea that, you know, that is going to be mandated or overseen in a way that kind of forces things one way or the other, because I sort of want my daughter to have this open-minded experience where she can find different things or protest different things. I kind of thought that was part of college. So talk a little bit about the student body, Pam, a little bit, and how, you know, this whole debate impacts them. It might jazz them up, like John was saying, in the classroom. They're, you know, really engaged in the conversation. It also might have a chilling effect. What do you think?
I actually think that, you know, as far as how we fund student organizations, or actually quite a few of the speakers that we bring to campus, those are funded using general activity fees that are collected from the students. And if you look at the text of the language, or the text of the letter that was sent to the Board of Regents, it's talking about basically state funds that are being used to pay for these things. So actually, I think student organization, you know, the wide variety, the options that are available, and a lot of the funding that would go towards supporting that diversity of experience, actually are those things are not even covered by the letter that was sent to the Board of Regents.
Okay, I want to jump in real quick and just let listeners know, and John and Pam know, because I don't think they know this, for the month of July, we're going to do a little SDPB summer school. And this is such a dynamic, fun, interesting, and controversial conversation. We're going to talk civics often throughout the month of July. We'll talk about what critical race theory is and what it isn't, the 1619 Project, the 1776 Project, and you'll be hearing a lot more about that. But in the interest of time, I want to quickly pivot to U.S. Senator John Thune, because there is speculation, but he has not confirmed whether he's going to run for another six-year term. He has not had to face that elusive fourth term that many of our representatives, congressional delegates, have in South Dakota. And people are starting to think Mitch McConnell is getting closer to retiring, and that might be an opportunity for John Thune. So some very brief thoughts on Senator Thune. John Schaff, you go first.
Well, I think you're right. I think we'd all be shocked if he didn't run for his fourth term and that he didn't win. And John Thune is the number two person in the Republican Party in the U.S. Senate. And it seems, I've said this for years when people have talked about whether he's going to run for president, that I think that the real goal of John Thune is to become Senate Majority Leader. Mm. And he's positioned himself throughout his Senate career in the committees he's been on and creating political action committees. And he's used his prodigious fundraising abilities not to win re-election here in South Dakota, because he does that relatively easily, but to help fund re-election for his colleagues in a way to build up that goodwill. And this is why, you know, and it seems, and there was a report a couple of weeks ago that by a slim margin, he has a lead over John Cornyn of Texas as being the guy that people would most like to see as Republican leader if Mitch McConnell steps down. So I think it's definitely in the cards if things play out the way we think they're going to play out.
Pam Caribou, 30 seconds. Thoughts on John Thune?
I agree. And I think that, you know, there's been some speculation that because Noam established a PAC with the FEC, the Noam Victory Fund, that she might be thinking about challenging Thune. But I actually think John's right, too, that she's going to use that money to support other candidates and possibly a run for the presidency. But I don't see her as seriously moving forward with a challenge to Thune.
Yeah. Professor Caribou, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Professor Schaff, thanks as well.
Pleasure as always.
The Dakota Political Junkies, that's a weekly feature here on In the Moment. You can hear our great team of political minds every Wednesday at 1220 Central, 1120 Mountain. Let's take a moment now to consider one of South Dakota's unsung gathering places, the record store. The resurgence of interest in vinyl has lifelong music collector David Herzrud of Sturgis thinking about what it means to flip through the bins and spend an afternoon looking for discoveries.
First of all, you've got something a little bit larger. You've got an album cover. I've collected album covers and autographed album covers for years and years and years. And there's something about just holding it in your hand. You know, a CD is kind of small, and the clarity, the reproduction on vinyl is so much different. Having an MP3 version just doesn't seem to cut it. There was a time when I absolutely positively loved going into a record store. It was always fun to walk in and talk to the people behind the counter, ask them if they've heard anything new and different, something that you should be aware of. A record store for me became kind of like a second home, and I just absolutely loved it. And it really kind of bothered me when I started seeing record stores going by the wayside, closing up. It really bothered me. But when vinyl started to come back, there suddenly was an opportunity for record stores to come back and be meaningful. And if you go into a lot of record stores today, you're going to find just as many people in a store as you did, say, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And Record Store Day was something that came about to try and get people back into record stores because the record manufacturers started to come to the realization that record stores were kind of the lifeblood of the industry. And there's a number of record stores in the state of South Dakota that are participating.
David Herzrud reviews new music releases for SDPB. He's a lifelong music collector and a former music industry marketing director. He's waiting to celebrate Record Store Day twice this summer, on June 12th and again on July 17th. Ahead on the program, not everyone is flocking to South Dakota. Some people are moving away. SDPB's Megan Fury reports on why some South Dakotans are seeking greener grasslands. You're in the Moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Comedian Byron Allen is one of the richest men in Hollywood, and he's now expanding his broadcast TV empire with the purchase of 7 local TV stations. We'll talk with him about his interest in local news and why he's taking on racism in the industry, one lawsuit at a time. That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding provided by First Dakota National Bank, supporting the businesses and individuals with a dream and the passion and drive to make it a reality. What will be your South Dakota first? More at firstdakota.com/first.
The businesses you hear on SDPB support us for a variety of reasons. The key reason is that they recognize this audience is unique. When your organization is mentioned as a supporter of SDPB, you're telling our loyal, engaged listeners that you care about the things they care about. Our audience pays attention and is more likely to do business with an organization that supports SDPB. We invite your organization to become an underwriter. Email underwrite@sdpb.org.
Healthcare is not only a matter of personal care, but also a major public policy issue. SDPB covers all angles of public health practices and procedures, from illness to recovery. The healthcare beat on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Coming Home is a public media collaboration that amplifies rural voices and rural stories. It's an in-depth and innovative look at our identity, our culture, our communities. While some of our communities are growing, others are fading as young people leave their hometowns in the rearview window. Overall, South Dakota's population is up 9% over the last decade. That's according to 2020 U.S. Census data. There are many reasons people move here. No state income tax, low cost of living, recreation, politics. But people are also moving away. A recent SDPB survey, that Coming Home, asked more than 1,000 people why they might leave. SDPB's Megan Feary reports on why people arrive and one, why some South Dakotans are seeking greener grasslands elsewhere.
South Dakota is overwhelmingly conservative, but that doesn't reflect everyone's politics. South Dakota Public Broadcasting worked with the Cheeseman Center at the University of South Dakota on the study. About 1,000 people across the state completed an online survey. There were separate virtual focus group interviews as well. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting provided funding. The SDPB survey shows the state's conservative agenda and position on social issues is the top reason some people might move away.
The legislature is consistently attacking our community. Just these ridiculous things that marginalize us even further. It just makes it really hard to want to stay in this state.
Cody Engel is vice president of Sioux Falls Pride, an LGBTQ nonprofit. He's originally from Indiana and moved here 7 years ago. Engel likes living in Sioux Falls, but
no matter how much work you're doing or how much time you're investing into organizations that are trying to create change, to every single year have the same exact situation occur, at some point it just becomes tiresome.
But Engel says he's not leaving yet.
Because if everybody leaves, then it's just going to stay stagnant. The people are just going to continue on with their antiquated beliefs.
Not everybody wants to bring change to South Dakota. Some just want out. Jeff Kleeman was born in Vermilion. He and his family left last May.
South Dakota is so behind on the times of everything. That was one of the main reasons we left. A lot of people are repressed and treated differently if they're not your traditional white person.
Kleeman says some South Dakotans deal differently with people who are transgender, gay, lesbian, or people of color.
They're all not treated as equal as white, and that was the reason we moved, because I want my kids to grow up in an environment where they're welcoming of all people. And that's not South Dakota unless you share their similar views.
Kleeman actually left twice. The first time, he couldn't find a job after graduating from the University of South Dakota.
The college experience is great, especially in Vermilion, but then, you know, when you get your bachelor's and you graduate, you're one of many, and you're not going to find a job.
Kleeman graduated in 2008 during the Great Recession. He says a lack of employment opportunities made it hard to stay.
And a lot of the older people will be like, pay your dues and go work. But I mean, you have a lot of student loan debt, and you're trying to find a home and start a family. It's difficult.
He and his family now live in Lincoln, Nebraska. He has a job he loves, and his family is happy. While Nebraska leans conservative, Lincoln is more progressive. They are not moving back.
I gave it a shot the second time, but I just never want to go back there except to visit.
Kleeman's experience is not unique. Many people leave the state after graduation. A 2019 congressional committee study found that South Dakota loses highly educated citizens at a higher rate than almost any other state. Paul Barron is the former executive director of the Board of Regents. His goal was to attract and retain college graduates.
The problem that South Dakota has is that it's a very insular state. So while you want people to stay there, they also need to have growth from the outside. It's not necessarily a particularly engaging place to be if you are not from South Dakota.
After politics, survey respondents say job opportunities are the second most common reason to leave the state. Some actively look for a job out of state. Others want to stay, but find there just aren't as many options. Here's Paul Barron again.
I think it's difficult to recruit people to a state that has really two centers of commerce and enterprise, essentially, you know, East River and West River. On the east side, I mean, there's only one big city. On the west side, there's tourism, and frankly, there's just not a lot in between other than agriculture.
Barron isn't from South Dakota, and he no longer lives here. He was let go after less than 2 years with the Board of Regents. He says he might know why.
They're really not friendly to outside ideas. They're limited because, frankly, people in the state, the board, they don't want to hear about or discuss or have anything brought up about equities of different people.
But Barron says he enjoyed his time here. He thought it was beautiful and the people were friendly. But it wasn't enough to stay.
When my job ended, that was not the place that we were going to retire. One of the things that we both wanted is a place where you measure snow in inches and not feet.
The SDPB survey also reveals some people would never leave the state. In fact, that is the third most common answer to the survey question. Kelsey Collier-Wise is the current mayor of Vermilion.
I love South Dakota, and I'm a fourth generation South Dakotan. And so, you know, this is where my dad is from, and, you know, his parents and his parents' parents. And so in that way, I have a connection to the whole state.
Collier-Wise went to college in Minnesota, but was homesick. She says she'll never leave again, even though she doesn't agree with the current political climate.
I struggle with some of these calls to get random conservative people to move to South Dakota when it doesn't even mean anything to them. It's like, this place doesn't belong to you just because you've got the same letter after your name as our governor. This is my home, and I don't have to lose that just because I have differing political views.
Vermilion's mayor says the idea that only conservatives would want to live in South Dakota is frustrating.
I think that the Gen X and early millennials, there was sort of this message that was sent to us that, like, if you're a progressive person, if you're a smart person, you leave the Midwest. And I think that now you just have a lot more people that are saying, like, no, I can be a progressive person and live in the Midwest. I can build a life here.
Collier-Wise says she does understand why people might move away. She's just not going to join them. People offer other reasons for why they would leave the state. They include increasing crime rates, particularly in large cities, and wanting to be closer to out-of-state family. The SDPB survey is part of an initiative from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Coming Home Project supports a deeper understanding of rural places. The full survey results will be available for public viewing at sdpb.org starting June 1st. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Megan Feary.
We are broadcasting live for In the Moment today from the Kirby Family Studio inside the Sioux Falls studio. And sitting across from the table with me, hello, it's Nate Weck. We're in the same room.
We are.
We're in the Kirby, and we are coming home to bringing people back into the studio. It's a good feeling.
Yeah, hey, Nate, how cool is this, huh?
It's pretty cool. It's a little bit trippy to look eye to eye to somebody after months of just listening in my ear. So I'm glad that you are my first guest across the table here. And it's graduation season. Things are starting to feel a little bit like a next normal. So tennis, track. Let's start with some real brief tennis stuff, please.
Yeah, so the boys' state tennis tournaments, girls are in the fall, so spring we always get the boys' tennis tournaments. There's two classes now. Monday, Tuesday last week was A. Thursday, Friday was class AA. And on the A side, Sioux Falls Christian won their very first boys' state tennis title, which was pretty cool. And their head coach's name is John Williams, which how cool is that? You know, not the composer, but I was hoping, you know, they'd play some Star Wars music as he walked, you know.
Team theme music, exactly. There you go.
So it was kind of cool talking to him, you know, and it obviously means a lot whenever you win the first one.
Sure.
We talked about girls basketball with Jared Bauman when White River won their first girls basketball title. So it's cool to always see the first. And then on the AA side, it was a very familiar face, and then Sioux Falls Lincoln winning their seventh straight state championship. And I think I counted their 19th in program history as well. So it's quite the program they have at Sioux Falls Lincoln when it comes to boys tennis and graduating two seniors. You know, I don't like to foreshadow what the future holds, but they're going to be very, very competitive again next year.
Yep. All right. I'm a Lincoln High School grad, so go Patriots. And let's talk state track and field. Lots of new fun and exciting and a little bit of madness thrown in with some locations.
Right. So it kind of goes back to the end of March when conversations had to start taking place about how are we going to run state track this year.
Yeah.
They had to make a decision. Obviously, a lot has changed here in the last couple of months. But at one point, you know, back at the late part of March, they had to make a decision. How do we want to do this? So they decided rather than having all three classes separated on day one and coming together for day two, they were just going to keep everything separated at three separate locations for the duration of the event. So class AA will be in Sturgis. Class A will be in Spearfish, and Class B will be in Rapid City. So all of them are going to be out in the Black Hills. It's just a matter of there's going to be some distance that kind of separates the three classes of competition. The good news for our viewers and people that are wanting to watch the action, all three classes will be live on SDPB television, and they will also be available to stream for free online at sdpb.org/track.
Nice work, SDPB sports team, because I'm guessing that's not as easy as
you know, it's, you know, you think about a normal year, it's just one venue you have to worry about setting up for track, and this year it was three. So I know Kyle Mork's done a lot of hard work preparing for this, getting his crews all lined up. So
shout out to the crews.
We're leaving tomorrow and looking forward to it. It's last year, as you know, most know, we didn't have a state track and field championships event because it got canceled. So I think everybody's just itching for this to happen because it is one of the bigger events of the year. And if you're a high school sports and activities fan, this is definitely the one event that you circle on your calendar because it's always around graduation season. Yep. And it's kind of that last hurrah for a lot. Even though we have golf in June, it is one of those events that's kind of the last hurrah for a lot of our student athletes that we have here in South Dakota.
And the ladies do not go first. They're going to be the marquee event. Tell me a little bit about switching up the order.
So the advisory committee for track decided that, you know, let's rotate this a little bit. So for each event that they have for running events, the boys this year will go first, and then the girls will go second. So it'll make it kind of fun at the end of the day because you get that 1,600-meter relay that kind of caps off the event. Kind of the main event, I guess you could say. So this year, the girls are going to have that main event spotlight. And, you know, that relay event that's at the end of the day, we've seen that sway some team points. So it is an event that has a lot of eyes on the product.
Yep.
So it is kind of that main event spotlight for a reason. And this year, the girls are going to get a chance to close out the event. So I think that's pretty cool. And it's the first time that this has happened. They can't confirm it all the way back to some of the really early days, but under the modern schedule era of state track and field here in South Dakota, it's the first time that the girls are going to be wrapping it up.
Oh, that makes me excited. I'm just thrilled to scream for the girls on SDPB TV. So go to our Facebook page, our sports page, our Twitter, SDPB sports page for all that coverage, and you'll see all the coverage from event to event on SDPB TV. Nate Wack, thank you so much. It's great to be here with you. Look forward to how some of this track and field plays out.
All right. Thanks, Lori.